The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, listeners. Welcome to our Friday Space Show program. Great to be here. I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you all for tuning in. Let me run through the announcements. We have a very exciting program for you today, and we want to spend lots of time talking to our guests. You can call us eventually on our toll-free line, 1-866-687-7223. Remember, no call screeners. Let it ring. We'll answer it and bring you up as quickly as possible on the air. The line is turned off for those of you who have been trying to call on the last 30 or 40 minutes, because I like to allow the guest to put forth his or her agenda and discussion topics for why she's on the Space Show, which seems reasonable to me. So I will let everybody know when we open the phone line and it is available for your calls. I would assume that'll be in about 20 or 25 minutes. But again, I will let everyone know, and I will repeat the number, 1-866-687-7223. You can also communicate with us by email. That account for today is drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. Please do recall that we are a copyrighted and trademarked program. You do have our permission to copy, download, and distribute our programs to people that you think may be interested in it. Please don't do any edits. Don't do anything commercial. No private YouTube channels or, you know, edits even for your own personal website. And we don't permit written transcripts, even if for your own personal use. If you do have ideas for something you'd like to do with a specific Space Show program, don't hesitate to email me about it at drspace@thespaceshow.com, and let's see what we can work out together. We also podcast. We do thank Andrew Grummet at gigadial.net, because he is our podcasting guy, and our podcasting client is Gigadial. You can find the RSS URL to subscribe to our podcast on our website, both of our newsletters. And in addition, you can find our podcast in iTunes, Microsoft Soon, Podcast Alley, AstroSpaceNow.com, YAstro.com, a host of other places on the Internet. If you do have podcasting questions, please do email me, drspace@thespaceshow.com. And that, by the way, is our website. So on our website, you will find our comprehensive newsletter, and it's uploaded Sunday evening. It has the details of the coming program for the week, guest bios, and it's the only place you will find the future events planned for the Space Show. Then if we have to change our schedule in any given week, which does happen, or we need to get something out to you in a hurry, it will appear first on the website newsletter. So I would suggest you check it from time to time to stay current on your programming for the week. And then if you want the very, very short email newsletter sent to you, which does go out email early Monday morning, California time, please send me your email address to drspace@thespaceshow.com, or you can use the pop-up window if your computer system accepts pop-ups. Everything we do on our program and our website is archived, going back to the beginning in 2001. As I keep saying, we're rapidly approaching the 2000th show, which will probably happen within the next 2+ weeks, depending on our schedule. And you can get all those programs right off of our website, or you can easily download the shows. If you have any questions, do let me hear from you. There's a Space Show store near the top of the website, so check it out. You will probably find some items of interest. I use it a lot for giving baby presents to people. And let's see, what else do I want to tell you? there is a guest search tool. So here you can do global searches like Word, Excel, PDF files, and you can pull up your favorite space term like microgravity or Mars, or your favorite guest like our guest today, and you'll get all of the dates where your search term or search person has been part of the space show, or you may find out that that person has never been a guest on the space show and you might want to recommend that person to me. And then once you have those dates, our website search engine searches by dates, and you can pull up all of those programs and hear them. To me, the most important program or item on the website is the Support the Space Show button. Remember, we are a 501c3 nonprofit with OneGiantLeapFoundation.org, and we exist because many of you do support us with your contributions. We thank you very much for that. That is what allows us to bring you all of our content free of charge. Remember that if you're a U.S. federal taxpayer, you do get a tax deduction. The same for those of you who pay California taxes. And if you have any questions, check out OneGiantLeapFoundation.org or send me an email at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then finally, do remember we're brought to you in part by the Secure World Foundation, and they do promote cooperative solutions for space security. You can get a lot more information about this great organization at their website, www.swfound.org, and they are the sponsors of our webinar series. And we're, as I say all the time, we're in a great relationship with Secure World. They do really great things, and I suggest you check them for their reports and, you know, their activities. You'll find that many of these topics are everyday topics on the space show. And that brings me to our program today, and it's really fun and a great honor and most interesting to bring back to the show Dr. Joan Vernikos. And Joan, she likes to be called Dr. Joan, by the way, is a world-class expert in stress and healthy aging. She retired from NASA not too long ago. She was the director of life sciences there from 93 to 2002. She followed with a career there as researcher and administrator. Since that time, she brings her knowledge and experience on healthy aging to the general public, and she has accomplished this as an author, consultant, motivational speaker, and personal health coach. She started at NASA for her stress expertise, and she pioneered research on how living in space and microgravity affected the health of the astronauts in the 70s. Dr. Jones sometimes even went behind the Iron Curtain. I wonder if all of you who are young listeners to the show even know what the Iron Curtain was, but that's a subject for another day. But she got behind the Iron Curtain and worked with Soviet Union space scientists in a rare showing of cooperative efforts between two Cold War enemies. Her full bio is up on the website, so you can read about it, but she has a great book out. Came out at the end of 2011, and we featured it on the Space Show and have talked to Joan about it. And I have personally given about 6 copies of this book to friends of mine. And this book is called Sitting Kills, Moving Heals, How Simple Everyday Movement Will Prevent Pain, Illness, and Early Death. I really recommend it. And for those of you who are finding medical costs to be skyrocketing and to being outrageous for members of your family, or you're being restricted on medications, or you can't find doctors if you're on Medicare, let me tell you, this is one of the most simple, effective how-to books to use gravity and her information from her space expertise to help keep you going strong for young and old. But the people I gave it to are all Medicare people. So, you know, we're all getting up there in years. So, again, Sitting Kills, Moving Heals. If we have time, we'll talk about it toward the end of the show. Dr. Joan, welcome back to the program. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. David, I'm very grateful and excited to be back on your show.
Do you know, because of your book, I used to sit at the desk doing the space show nonstop from the 90 minutes, and sometimes the shows would go more than 2 hours, and I would never get up. So I set up a little reminder, and now about every 20 or 30 minutes, I get up, and I have a really long headset cord, and the microphone is on a really long boom item, and I walk around the desk about every 20 or 25 minutes for 5 minutes or 7 minutes or so, so I don't sit for the entire show anymore, and that is a direct result of reading Sitting Kills, Moving Heels.
Oh, what a tribute.
I can't tell you it's made me thin or any less stressful, but it makes it more interesting. Inspiration Mars, are they going to be able to get up and move around? Or are they going to be strapped in or sitting down for 500 plus days?
I hope not. I hope they'll be able to move around. And, I think what we want to talk about is that there are other ways of moving around, and the astronauts already have taught us all along, all the 56 years that we've been out there, that there are different ways of doing things and creative ways of stimulating the body to replace the information or the stimulation that gravity normally provides for us.
So, what do you think of this mission? Is it on the outer edge of doable? Is it not doable? Is it really inspiring? Give us your sort of overview from what you know about it.
I am very excited about it, and I find it very inspiring. And good luck to them, because I think it's a fantastic look. Anytime you are excited and passionate and want to move ahead, want to break the barrier. And this is a barrier, let's face it. It is an exciting venture. And to say that it's bad news, it can't be done, is defeatist right from the start. The question is that there are some very good heads that have come together. Very good heads. And yes, they may have been influenced by their enthusiasm, perhaps. But I don't think they overlook details, because these are very careful people. I am in awe of all the mathematics and the calculations that they're going through, not my area. I look at it from the point of view of, is it doable? I believe it is. Engineers are fantastically creative at devising ways of breaking barriers, and then we stick the human in it. And that comes to where I come from, which is how can we make it possible so that it is a success? And that's what we have to work for. We need to take the attitude that it can be done and it can be successful. Now what do we need to do?
So your approach is, yeah, it can probably be done. Let's look at what we have to do to make that happen.
Exactly.
I'm going to ask you an advanced email question I got just to get it off my desk, okay?
Because
we're really not there yet in the discussion, but it is an interesting discussion. This is from Dwayne in Washington, D.C., and he says, one thing I wonder about is the overall air quality in a closed vehicle like that. What happens with bacteria and the like? Even with good filtration, I wonder if it's possible for people to get sick in such an environment. I don't think he's talking about space sickness. I think he's talking about, from breathing infected air. Can you comment on that idea?
I'm sure he's right, and we don't know. What we do know is that 6 months in space, which is the limit, we've had someone up there, or 18 months in space, which is the limit the Russians have had someone up there, Polyakov, in perhaps even worse conditions than we experience on space station. I don't know. I can't say that for sure. But I've seen the Russian life support system, and it was relatively simple. It seemed simple. And if there is an interaction between the human and the environment they're in, and though there are going to be bacteria that they bring with them, they won't be changing. They may be changing in virulence or the sensitivity of the individual will change. which we know it does. So the end result may be complicated, and we need to look at that interaction of the human and the bacteria and the environment. But yes, there is a lot of information, excellent work that has been done on the virulence, increased virulence in space of microorganisms and the decreased immunity that results in space, increased sensitivity to bacteria and other viruses and other microorganisms. But so far, it has been coped with. And it is a question of adjusting to the adapting to this environment. And as long as they're not going to be interacting with new, unknown organisms. You know, after all, after Apollo, we had them in quarantine. Remember?
Right. They came back on a trailer on the carrier.
Yeah. And it was a just-in-case situation. Let's watch and see. And some precautions like that will have to be taken before and after.
So one of the risks, I would think, is that something happens to their air filtering and purification system, or even their air supply system. And since they need to be self-contained with parts and capabilities of repairing, and they don't have the right parts or they can't repair it, their goose is probably cooked, right?
Well, the life support system, as far as I'm concerned, on any prolonged mission, that has to be self-sufficient, and let's face it, we don't have one today. It is not a closed-loop system.
Right.
What we have is not a closed-loop system. We need to resupply. If they can overcome that, then the mission is going to be successful.
And if they're still only partially closed, it's still a big risk, right?
It is a risk. There are lots of risks. And the question is to be sober about it and to list the risks not as a negative.
Did you say to be sober about it?
Yes, I did.
That's a good way of saying it. But, you know, there are people around that will take any risk for any reason that they think. So that's not a stumbling block in terms of whoever they get to go on the mission or the people putting the mission together.
That is true. I remember many, many years ago when I was doing research at Ames Research Center, one day coming across a very young Chris McKay.
Oh, Chris McKay. Well, he still is very young. At least he looks young when I see him.
And I asked him if he would go to Mars, and he said, tomorrow. I said, one way? He said, one way. Now, he was very young, and he may have changed his mind since. But there are a lot of very intelligent, very capable people who would go one way. Now, I think as a society, then the issue becomes, are we going to allow people, in spite of themselves, to go one way.
Well, let me ask you this. Why is it society's business if we want to go one way to Mars or one way to any place, any more than it's society's business about my building a deep-sea submersible and wanting to dive the Marianas Trench, which what's-his-name just recently did? Why do we have to make that society's business?
As long as government is not involved, as long as it's not taxpayers' money, it is not their business.
Okay, so with Inspiration Mars, I understand that NASA is not financially involved, but they are helping in consulting and stuff, so you have non-cash benefits flowing to them, possibly.
Well, that's advice.
Yeah, so does that count as government involvement?
Only if it is conditional. In other words, if it is advice freely given that you can take or not, okay?
Okay.
Then it is fine. But if the advice is, you know, either, you know, if you want our advice, you must do this. then that's a different issue, and you have to look at it and decide whether you want it or not.
There is another large group of people that I have heard from since Inspiration Mars started who do not think government should allow the mission because they believe the crew will be killed and that it will set back human spaceflight to Mars decades. Now, I'm not in that camp. I don't believe that. And I do look at Challenger and Columbia, and it did not set back human spaceflight for decades. They stood down to make some adjustments and repairs and eventually got going again. Well, what are your thoughts? Should
I am with you. I believe, first of all, I talk to people and listen to people, and there's been so much buzz and so much excitement about this mission. They all say, oh, yes, but, you know, they may die. Okay? Well, every astronaut, every test pilot that I've known, in fact, many years ago, I remember Leo Fox. I don't know if anyone remembers Leo Fox.
Yeah.
Took me to Edwards to meet with pilots who were testing the unmanned vehicles. In those days, they were testing them with a pilot in the cab, although the pilot was not in charge and operating it. The guy from the ground was operating it. And they were testing these things for the first time. I mean, the risks involved were huge. And I was, you know, in the stress business, and I was interested to know whether the guy on the ground was more stressed than the person up there whose fate was being decided by somebody else. Naive, yeah. Anyway, I met with these characters, who were wonderful, Bill Dana and others, and about five of them. And after I was through it, they said, well, what do you want? I said, well, I would like a little urine. And they said, and they listened to me. And what would you get out of it? Well, I want to find out, you know, what is stressful in this situation. And finally, the Dana stood up and then the others, and they looked at me, and I was young. And they said, little lady, why would I want to know if I was stressed? And I thought, oh, my goodness, you know, it's true.
Well, yeah, this is their dread because they're afraid their flight ticket will get pulled.
Well, exactly.
By those evil flight surgeons. And I would imagine the doctors for the astronauts have that same issue.
Yeah.
Listeners, I am going to open the phone lines because we've been talking for about 23 minutes. So you can call and talk to Dr. Joan, and please do keep it relevant to our discussion today. 1-866-687-7223. No call screeners, and if you can use the phone, please do have at it. Has anyone from Inspiration Mars checked in with you, asked you to consult? Do you have any relationship with them?
No.
So we're just getting that clear.
I have no conflict of interest.
What do you think about, I mean, they're going to be in this, as I understand from Tabor, who did a John Batchelor show segment with me, they don't really go out or come back in the capsule. The capsule part is primarily for reentry and coming back to Earth. They're going to be in an adjoining habitat, and that's where they're going to spend all of their time going out on the mission and then coming in. So details are really kind of sketchy on what that habitat may be and how big it may be and what it has in it. But it's probably bigger than any of the capsules that we know about, probably even bigger than the Orion capsule were they to try to use an Orion. So is there a way of determining how much space a person needs on a long duration space flight? I mean, not necessarily to be comfortable, because I don't think these people are going to be very comfortable, but just in terms of their basic needs as people for air and whatever they use and stuff like that. Is there a formula or something for that?
I, you know, we've had people going granted, not for very long in capsules like Mercury, where you could hardly budge and had to crawl in to Skylab, which had quite a bit of room. And then probably the longest mission, and our experience with longer missions are from Salyut. It was not very big. And then Mir. And, of course, Space Station, which is quite large, but then has a lot more people in it. I don't know how Salyut, for instance, would compare with this capsule in volume. But volume is not so much the issue as the interaction of the people one with the other. And there should be some way of a private area, whether it's a little haven or a haven from radiation or a haven from something, bunk bed, anything. To get away one from the other. One of the things the cosmonauts have said to me over the years, several of them, Oleg Atkov, who's a cardiologist, and then Yakov himself, is that you go through cycles of loving and hating the persons you're with. Something like two biweekly cycles. And when you hate them, you need to be able to get away. Now, some of them have gone on the treadmill and exercised like crazy because that was the only way they could get away from the other people. But that's something that's come out of the literature and of the experiences that has to be taken into consideration over a long, when someone's cooped up with someone else over a long period of time. But we come down to basics. What are the issues in a flight in a relatively small space? The issues are life support, number one. Far more important than anything else. Like Jim Bajan said to me once, I want to know I can breathe. That's fundamental.
I think so, yes.
Okay. Human factors, the interrelationships. And there you have, here you have two people, and how they do or don't get along. And over time, in close proximity, things that may not have been irritating can become irritating. And again, there is no, the science is peculiar, that it's fine what you find out from the people you're testing, but it doesn't necessarily apply globally, apply to others. So it's very difficult to know or to predict who will and won't get along with each other. Yes, there are questionnaires, and yes, but you don't know how they're going to change.
The fact that they're saying they think a married couple would be better in terms of getting along and all that, is there any reason to believe that's true?
you tell me.
Well, listen, I'm divorced. Well, we might have killed each other.
Married couples, okay. And what's the... They may have gotten along together famously, and then one fine day decide they've missed out on something. It's a very tricky thing, and it's very hard to predict. You can only do the best you can in saying... And then one other's opinion of what going on there between two people is also... But, anyway, knowing how you can support them, knowing what you can provide, whether it's communications, which of course is going to be an issue at some point in time. The biggest beef astronauts and cosmonauts have had is not so much the interaction among themselves, as the interaction with ground control. Because ground control come and go and go to their jobs, and it's the same thing like my volunteers in bed rest when the staff would go home at the end of the day. That's what irritated them. and you didn't. I mean, I had trained them. I would not allow them. We had hours that were unpredictable when people came and went. So there was not this finality of, you know, everyone else is going home, and I have to stay here. I'm stuck, helpless.
Of course, they volunteered to be in the bed rest study.
But once they were in that situation, their whole perspective changes.
So we revert to victimhood, huh?
We revert to victimhood, right, very easily.
Tim sent in an email, and I might as well bring this in right now, too, since
okay.
And then we have a caller on hold that we'll go to. He wanted to know if you know how the Inspiration Mars team will deal with the potential or the issue of acute radiation poisoning from a CME.
No, I do not. I think, you know, when I remember way back in the Soviet Union when they showed me their Mars habitat of a transport vehicle, really, they had a haven. And the haven was provided some escape. The other side is the research, and there have been tremendous advances in terms of fortifying the individual or making the individual more suitable. I felt way back, and I was shot down all over the place, you know, we have differences, genetic differences in sensitivity to radiation. This is used, it's established now and is used for radiation treatment. But could we select astronauts on the basis of their sensitivity to radiation? My goodness, it absolutely damned me for even bringing it up. But I think on a mission like this, you have to have, as a criterion of selection, their sensitivity to radiation. Can be done, number one. Number two, once you have less sensitive people to the radiation, there's one protection left. Okay?
Right.
The next protection is to get to the people who do biological engineering and say, okay, you have these people, how can you make them even more resistant? And this is the kind of thinking that has to be brought to bear. It is not using what we've been doing for 60 years over and over and over again, where they go into orbit and they come back. It has to be a completely different way of looking at what you need. Yes, with what we have and what we've done, because there isn't time to do much more between now and then. Something that you need to focus on. You need to say, okay, what am I going to do with these people who are going to be zapped? Assume they're going to be zapped. You have to fortify it. You have to fortify their sensitivity to radiation, their resistance to radiation. You have to fortify their immune system. You have to, these are the approaches you need to take. You have to give them an array of countermeasures, not this usual over and over tweaking of how much exercise you're going to get. It's archaic. It's good. I'm not saying they shouldn't exercise. If you have the room to put all kinds of these exercise devices, by all means, do them. Good luck to you. But, you know, even the old Exogeni that the Apollo and the Gemini astronauts use of the bands, you know, it was way back to basics of what they're trying to do today, of resistive exercise, number one. Number two, there are other ways that NASA's too archaic to adopt, like all kinds of yogic activities, yogic respiration. We can control space motion sickness without a problem, can control post-flight orthostatic hypotension without a problem, that can maintain your health, meditation for mood, I mean, yes, it smacks of alternatives, but no more. There is a lot of research that indicates how these approaches, these alternative approaches, can maintain someone in the health in which they want to be. And it's so, the mind, their minds are so closed to new ideas.
Well, do you know if the Inspiration Mars teams are considering new approaches and alternatives, or are they looking for variations on the same old, same old?
To give them credit, I don't know if they're looking at them, number one. Number two, my guess is, from past experiences, that, you know, you get what you... Mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the fairest of them all? You get the answers that have been given for years and years and years. And you cannot think of exploration. You couldn't, even in the NASA framework, cannot think of exploration without stepping back and saying, hey, look, we've been doing this kind of exercise for 60 years. More is better. More isn't necessarily better. It's still, we've never flown anyone without countermeasures, let's face it. And that would be unethical. So we don't know how badly they would be if they hadn't done something. I'm not saying it hasn't helped, but if you lose, you know, whatever, 5% of your bone, 10% of your bone in 6 months, that's not small change. You cannot keep thinking the same old way. You've got to step back and say, okay, what can I do? What can I give this person that they can do for themselves? Not what I can do. It's not the pills I'm going to give them. That's the last thing you want. I mean, look, Bill Rowe, okay?
Yeah, he wants to call in. In fact, he might be the guy on hold. I don't know who's on hold.
Well, let me tell you what I think of what Bill Rowe has done. Bill Rowe has done an extraordinary thing, which was to look at old data. Data that exists. Data that was not accessible to people. Data from Apollo astronauts and that you can't get unless they die and then it's free available.
Well, even then he has hell to go to get the data. So
I know.
They're not very forthcoming.
But look, there's data galore that once the mission was over, nobody ever looked at it again. Okay? Now, there is we have Skylab samples, not data. Not only data, but samples in the freezer that can be used. I had talked to Savinoff, a terrific bone researcher, years ago, about finding the genetic predisposition to bone loss in the Skylab astronauts, because there was one guy that didn't lose any bone. Why? He did exactly the same thing as everybody else. Again, you should select or beef up that genetic predisposition so that you don't lose the things we know you're going to lose in flight. You see where I'm coming from?
Absolutely.
It's a completely different way of thinking. And you cannot keep doing the same thing just tweaking it. And that's where I think yoga therapy, for instance, and meditation would be fantastic, because they can learn to do that. You know, monks, for instance, in Tibet, can sit in the freezing snow for hours and their body temperature does not drop. Okay. I am told they need to have practiced a long time, thousands of hours of meditation to be able to do that. Well, that, you know, we've got time. Let's do it.
Let's see who's on the call holding, okay?
Okay.
Hi, caller. Are you still with us, please?
Still with you. Bill Rowe.
Well, it is the man of the hour. Hi, Bill.
Hi, how are you?
We're fine. How are you? It's good to hear from you again.
Well, listen, I've enjoyed the conversation very much, and I just feel compelled to put in my 2 cents. I'm an adventurer. I would love to see this mission successful. My argument is that we've got to wait till the next, at least till the next opportunity comes around. Now, Tito, I figured out, Tito will be 90 years old when Mars and the Earth are sufficiently close again. If Tito lives long enough, we've got a much better chance, he has a much better chance of seeing both of these passengers arrive back to Earth. I haven't even looked at the radiation problems that exist. I've spent the last 20 years really doing research about the vulnerability of the blood vessels in space, and I haven't even looked at the radiation, and I don't want to discuss it or think about it. But even without thinking about radiation, I'm concerned that we're going to have either two badly decomposed bodies return from Mars, or there will be one decomposed body, and then we have to find out, before we do anything else, how that decomposed body can be destroyed, because otherwise the other passenger will probably die from sleep deprivation with the odor, plus the psychological factors. The problem is, and the reason that I feel that we should wait, David, you mentioned Columbia and the Challenger, and then in 2 or 3 years we were back in business again. This is an entirely different situation. We're talking about human beings, passengers, and these passengers really will be extremely vulnerable. Suppose one of these passengers has a heart attack 6 weeks or 6 months or longer during the mission. How will that person be treated? There is no question that there is impairment in absorption of food and pharmaceuticals and minerals in space. So therefore, I have been publishing over and over that we need subcutaneous pharmaceuticals, and really none, I looked into this, there really are none available except insulin. We can't use pharmaceuticals which are absorbed through the skin because those techniques won't be adequate. And we have to replace not only magnesium but calcium. We have to determine what the ratio between magnesium and calcium is before we can begin to go up there. On Earth, the calcium-magnesium intake ratio is 2-to-1. We don't know what it is in space. These are just some of the problems that I'm concerned about, and I don't want to take any more time. I understand, Joan, where you're coming from, and I understand, David, where you're coming from. I'd love to see you succeed, but these are the things that bother me.
Hang on for Joan to respond to you, Bill. Don't get off the phone. Joan, do you want to comment?
Yes, I know Bill's thinking, and I agree with a lot of what he's saying, that we don't know a lot of what's happening. You know, there are, with any mission, there are risks that have to be taken. And there are things that can be done right now in terms of the approach to bone loss, the approach to cardiovascular changes. As Bill so rightly says, the magnesium, the vitamin D3, because we know that the light intensity in a spacecraft is going to be very low for a long time. And so you have to replace certain things. But this can be done in a very systematic way with the best knowledge we have at the time. We cannot go with a pharmacy on board. And we can only do the best we can with what's available. Way back when we had the blue teams and red teams for exploration, God knows how many years ago that was, 20, 25, one of the concerns of the docs was, what would we do with the bodies? And how to have supplies for 30 days of intensive care. Well, come on. I mean, who's going to keep somebody on a mission to Mars, 30 days on in intensive care. You don't do that on an exploration. Shackelford didn't. It's just not the nature of exploration, and it has to be couched entirely as an exploration mission.
So how do you get rid of the body?
There's vacuum in space.
Well, yeah, but that assumes that you have a way to open an airlock and get rid of it.
Well, at some point you may have to devise a way of doing that. Having something, what do you do with the toilets in space? They use vacuum from the outside. I think that's the best. It's desiccation. It's the best preservative, non odors. Besides, you get used to the odor. I can tell you any odor, very quickly. You recall the original spacecraft that landed on the carrier. The astronauts weren't smelling anything, but the moment it opened, everybody stepped back. So you do accustom yourself to the smell. That's not a serious issue. I think the body, there must be a way of preserving the body of desiccation using the vacuum of space. And something that, you know, they may want to think about.
Bill, responses?
Bill, why can't we wait 25 more years? I'll still be alive.
Uh-huh.
You know, 25 years from now, I'll still be alive. I'm positive.
Good for you.
But I don't think that. I think that it's somewhat selfish on Tito's part not to wait 25 more years until we've got a better chance of making it. Why can't he just wait 25 years? He'll be 90. What's the matter with that?
Bill, let me tell you. We have waited for exploration since Skylab. The thing after Skylab was station and exploration. This is the way von Braun had thought. This is the way that the original space planning had gone. And what happened? We got bogged down with doing the same thing over and over again. Exploration came and went. We've done more reports and plans for exploration. We've studied it more. We've talked about artificial gravity and spinning the spacecraft. Star Trek came and went, and we're still stuck in planning.
You know, I was in the late 90s, and I won't mention the name. In the late 90s, I was in a small NASA meeting in Washington, and one of the astronauts who was on the moon came up to me during the coffee break, and he told me that in the last 25 years, and that was in the late 90s, really very, very little had been accomplished as far as space medicine is concerned. And I'm very, very concerned that since the late 90s, very little has also been accomplished. I think that it's not only money. I think that we need better scientists to come on board in NASA than have existed so far. This is my way of thinking, anyhow.
Well, the team, to give them credit, the team of researchers across the country that have been involved in NASA has grown and developed, and there are some really top-notch people. When it comes down to what will actually be used, it then comes down to the same stuff. I mean, that's why I think this is an opportunity to force the issue. To say, look, we've got 4 years, 3 years, 3.5 years of leeway. What ways are there? Not just the NASA ways, but what ways are there everywhere, anywhere? What thinking can be applied like the thinking you've applied on the endothelium and the role of magnesium and you know, on the sensitivity of the system and the interaction with space? I mean, you took old data that existed for eons. Nobody looked at it because that's the way we do things. Or we turn it over to a contractor, and the contractor doesn't know what questions to ask and what to look for. So I really think that it's time. It would be good for NASA as well. This would be fantastic for NASA, if nothing else, to force the thinking. To step back and say, okay, what is our menu of possibilities? Crazy. Just tell me anything. And then you can go through and evaluate them in a logical way. Not done. You've got to come at it with an open mind. You can't come at it with, this is what works, this is what we're doing, and therefore we have to use what we're doing.
You know, Bill, if they had announced this for 2032, they would have zero attention on their project.
Yeah.
Nobody would care.
No.
I don't want to be too cynical, given my nature of being cynical anyway, but to raise money to establish an interest level in the project to buck some of the naysayers and potential regulatory authorities early on, then announcing a 2018 window, even if they don't make it, accomplishes all of that. And as a lot of people have said in notes to me, even if they miss their launch deadline, even if they determine for whatever reason they can't make it, and TITO does raise substantial parts of the money, maybe not all of it, more than likely TITO is using that money to advance the research needed for out-of-the-box solutions to pull off this mission. So it hasn't, you know, been a bust by any means.
Well, I commend both of you. I think both of you are very, very excited, and I hope that I'm wrong. It really sounds like a very, very interesting program, and I'll turn this over to someone else. I hope I'm wrong.
If they do it, are you going to follow it?
Well, I, God almighty, you know, I'm not getting any younger, but sure, hell yes, I will. All right, thanks very much.
Thanks, Bill. We appreciate hearing from you always.
Bye.
Listeners, the line is open at 866-687-7223. Joan, you up for taking a short 3-minute break?
Yes.
Okay. Listeners, we're going to break. We'll be back with you in 3 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of the Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. And welcome back, everybody. This is part two of our Friday Space Show program. We're talking to Dr. Joan today, and we have a caller on hold. Caller, who are you, please, and welcome to the program.
Thank you. This is Doug from Southern California.
Okay, and Joan, Doug is a doctor in Southern, an MD doctor in Southern California.
Okay.
Go ahead, Doug.
Yeah, you know, in the medical field, we have this thing called 5150, which is, a sort of procedure for involuntary admission, like the psychiatric unit, for people who are either have homicidal ideation or suicidal ideation, where the, threat to other people or to themselves. And the law recognizes that if somebody is, I guess what I'm sort of getting at is exactly what is suicide. You know, if one goes on a mission to Mars, is it considered threatening to themselves? And I think probably a distinction would be is that, you know, all effort is being made for them to survive the trip, and they are intending not to kill themselves. I don't think, I'm not imagining that the government would really have a legal basis to prevent this from happening. That's one comment that I have.
Joan?
Yes. I thought there was another comment coming. I think that's an interesting perspective, but wouldn't you think that there would be a way of finding out that whether they intended to commit suicide?
Well, I think the government's knowledge of the program, they wouldn't have really any reason to think that they are, specifically not planning on coming back, that this is really a suicide mission.
Well, of course, they could deny a launch license for any number of reasons. Maybe people in NASA secretly or other people in the government secretly complain and say, don't give them a launch license. And then end of story, as long as they're American citizens or they've got American components in their hardware.
That's entirely possible. I'm just saying from these people are going to kill themselves, and therefore, that's the explicit reason given. I'm not imagining that that would be the case.
So we have suicide by cop, we have suicide by rocket launch. Is that, is that what you're suggesting might be out there?
Burial in space will be the next. We've had that already, haven't we?
Yes.
And another comment that I have is, let's remember that this Russian cosmonaut, I think he was up in a single time, wasn't it, 438 days? Is that right?
Yes.
That comes to about 93% of a 501-day mission.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think that what we're talking about with 501-day mission is really all that much further out than what we've already
experienced.
I agree with you.
Microgravity, I should say.
Well, keep in mind that he was inside the Van Allen belt, so these guys are going outside the Van Allen belt, so it's a whole different ballgame.
Well, and that's why I mentioned through and at the last about microgravity. In other words, now he's going to be outside, they'll be outside the Van Allen belt, but if you think about it, where they are, I don't believe because they're above the atmosphere, it doesn't protect much from the galactic cosmic rays except for the shielding from the Earth, right?
Well, yeah, but when they're in LEO, they're protected. To a large degree, it's when they go out beyond LEO that they're not protected.
From GCRs? I thought GCRs were so high energy that they are only stopped by the atmosphere, not the magnetic field.
No, they get, as I understand it, and I certainly will defer to Joan, but they are shielded to a large degree within inside the Van Allen belts, and it's when they go outside where they have the higher risk. Remember, when the people who say we never went to the moon used this as one of the arguments and saying that you couldn't have gone to the moon because you would be outside the Van Allen belts, and even though there were no CMEs or anything, you couldn't have survived the radiation. And one of the explanations was you're going so fast through them for such a short period of time, it was not a relevant risk. But now you're going outside the Van Allen belts, and you're not doing it for a short period of time, so it does become a relevant risk.
Can we clarify? Because we're talking about there's radiation, there's the normal cosmic radiation from the sun, then there's CMEs, then there's GCRs. And then there's the Van Allen belts themselves that have radiation, so four different types of radiation. So I just like to focus on the GCRs, the really high energy ones.
Mm-hmm.
I thought those were stopped by the atmosphere, not by magnetic fields of the Earth. Do we know?
I believe so.
I can't give you the specifics on that. I don't know, but I'm sure someone will call in or email in and give us the facts on that. I do know that they're talking about shielding when Marcelo is on the show from Brookhaven, and he's actually coming back on the show in several weeks to talk specifically about radiation on this mission.
Mm-hmm.
The shielding, the radiation's issues are the major big event like the CME or the solar flare, plus your exposure to the galactic cosmic rays. And that is different from within Leo.
Yes.
So I cannot give you the specifics, but again, maybe someone will call in who can.
No, but let me add something here, and that is that our focus has been on the radiation.
Okay.
The focus of NASA has been much less so on how you can increase the resistance of the individual and on shielding materials. Okay? We know that there are materials that are fantastic shields. Okay, you can have lead and whatever. But water, for instance, obviously, is a fantastic, provides fantastic shielding. And polyethylene. And to the extent that people who have done a little bit on that, but have been thinking a different way of developing shielding, more effective shielding for what we know is going to exist and assume it's going to be devastating, have to be brought together to think again, to think differently, and look at the situation on how you can make the best of the situation you're going to have.
One final thing, and then I'll get off the phone here, is, I think that there's, I haven't heard much discussion about this, but I think that there might be real value psychologically in having a regular daily work schedule.
Mm-hmm.
that's useful. I think there's a whole slew of things that can be done, such as producing commercials or, drinking Pepsi from free space sort of thing. But also, producing videos that we've sent back for, broadcast in schools and things of this nature. So with that, I'll clear the line.
Thank you, Doug.
Okay.
So, listeners, again, if you want to use the line, it is 1-866-687-7223. You can also use email, drspace, drspace, @thespaceshow.com. Joan, do you have any indication of the willingness of anyone involved in these mission plannings, whether they be NASA people or Boeing people or new space people or whoever? Do they look at these at this wide range of human factors, we call them, and do they look for a different way of solving them, or do they only look at advancing what they know? Are you able to sort of give us a ballpark estimate?
I think they have good advice that they have thought, but I think there is more that is younger. And younger doesn't necessarily mean in age. Younger ways of looking at the problem or something done elsewhere, in other countries, or in places that have not been particularly funded by NASA, but funded by commercial artists.
You know, Dr. Rowe, he didn't really talk about this, but he has on the show, talks about the solar radiation resistance here on Earth, of people in the Himalayas, for example,
yeah.
And the Bushmen of Kalahari, which can just run endlessly, you know, to chase their animals for nonstop for days and days at a time. They can outrun the animal and outlast them, and they're pretty much near the equator, so the amount of radiation they get from the sun is significantly greater than we do. They're scantily clothed to begin with, and they don't have the problems with the sun and things that we have. So why is that? And Bill looks at that information, which is really amazing.
Yes, it is. And he's absolutely right. And as I said earlier, we know there have been lots of studies on the genetic sensitivity or resistance to radiation. And this has been used as a factor in radiation therapy for various cancers, so that you can localize the damage and not, you know, kill the whole individual. So it's known. It's a question of tapping into that. Okay, so it's not the kind of radiation you have in space, not the GTR particularly. But it's a start, and we have Brookhaven. As you said, Lord knows I started it. I funded the rest of the thing. And let's take advantage of it. Let's compare. Let's compare what is known clinically, what is practiced clinically in oncology and radiation therapy with what we need or what we know is space-related. And it's not, in this case, it's not a shortage of funds. NASA needs to know. Okay, it's not a shortage of funds in the NASA radiation program, which is the best funded program in the whole of the life sciences, has been from its inception. And let's tap that in the same way we need to go around and say, look, let's take these samples from Skylab that are sitting in the freezer, and let's do the DNA on these people, and then correlate it to what actually happened after 84 days in space. Why? What made the difference? How can we use that? How can we use that in selecting the two people who will go? So that they go with an advantage, with a handicap, that's an advantage, not a liability. That's one approach.
You have another caller. Let's see who's on. Hi, caller. Are you still there with us, please?
Yes, I'm here.
And you are?
My name is Dr. Dilip, D-I-L-I-P, Sarkar, S-A-R-K-A-R.
Good afternoon or good morning. Welcome to the show. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Norfolk, Virginia.
Okay.
I'd like to ask Joan about a couple of questions.
Go ahead. Can you speak up just a little bit, please, sir?
Yes. Joan, you're talking about a space flight.
Mm-hmm.
And we know, you know, I'm a physician, and we know that for a long-term space flight, you develop the physiological changes of premature aging. Your bone gets demineralized, you get osteoporosis, muscle tone goes down, and because of lack of gravity, you get a fluid shift. When you come back, your head is swollen, eyes are swollen, you get an edema, upper part of the body, you get a loss of balance. It's a severe physiological changes in a long-term space flight. And we have tried everything. You know, they've been exercising, they've done all this stuff. I am a yoga therapist. I also practice yoga myself. And we have seen the physiological changes of yoga, which is anti-aging, which completely reverses the physiological changes of people in a microgravity or a zero gravity for a long time. So do you have any information or do you know anything about using yoga as a pre-flight conditioning of these people who are going to a long space flight, like going to the Mars? And do you have any comments on that?
Well, thank you for asking the question. Thank you, Dr. Phillips. I I'm a great believer in the fact that there are, first of all, the importance of giving the subject, the individual, something that they can do for themselves rather than something they are told to do. Finding answers in the yogic repertoire is an area of omission, shall we say, in the NASA environment. Now, to tell the truth, individual astronauts, the reason that yoga was not taken seriously, shall we say, by NASA, has been that astronauts would not, it would be a sissy thing for astronauts to do. Okay? On the other hand, I know astronauts, several astronauts, who themselves have taken up yoga of various varieties because they felt the need for something to help them. However, these countermeasures, to use the NASA parlance, have not been used, as far as I know, in flight. Nor have they been used, which I think is even more important, in rehabilitation after they return. Or in preparation. And not in a consistent, designed way to determine which are most valuable. Now, there are a variety, as you know very well, of breathing exercises. By the way, David, Dr. Sarkar was a cardiac surgeon. So he's come from the traditional field.
Yes, I just found his website and was reading his residency and surgical appointments and his hospital appointments off of his bio. So I'm aware of that.
You can look at my website, my full name, Dilip. DILIPSARKR, DilipSarkar.com. And I'm a retired surgeon. I retired for a reason. I opened up surgeries. I've adopted yoga in my daily practice. It's a lot of improvement. But what I find it out, Joan, is that in a practice of yoga, what it does, just simply, if you can keep your head down, that pressure inside your head goes up, pressure inside the eyes goes up, pressure, carotid artery goes up. But when you keep your head down for a longer period of time, what happens, the baroreceptors comes into play and the baroreflex slowly and slowly lowers that pressure, intracranial pressure, intracarotid pressure, intraocular pressure. The pressure stabilizes. Even when the person can practice a head down or a headstand and stay there, the body's whole hemodynamics gets completely balanced. So this can be used as a countermeasure in flight, because when they have a microgravity, when they're head down and sit up, their baroreflex sensitivity is already there. And then it comes in the breathing exercises, which is called in yogic term is called a pranayama, the breathing exercise, which we found out that inhalation, breathing in, is sympathetic. Breathing out, exhalation, is parasympathetic. When you practice a yogic breathing, like a lung is like a balloon, you want to exhale longer than inhale. That means you want to remove more carbon dioxide and bring more oxygen in. Example being, you inhale, count of two in, one and two in, and one and two and a three and a four out. You get a shifting of your whole autonomic imbalance to parasympathetic system. And then slowly and slowly what happens, body gets tuned to rapid shifting, which is basically called autonomic nervous balance. And these, we believe that if we can incorporate these breathing techniques, the yogic postures, then even relaxation, So yoga is completely opposite of exercise. In exercise, muscle contracts, you know, your heart rate goes up, blood pressure goes up, respiratory rate goes up. But yoga is a total relaxation response. Muscle relaxes, so you can stay in a pose, you can be flexible. So in the space when there is no gravity, when the muscle relaxes, the muscle is already used to relaxation in the, you know, before the pre-flight. So what happens, it changes your brain. The term we use called neuroplasticity. The brain knows the muscle needs to be relaxed. Brain knows you need to have a baroreceptor sensitivity. Brain knows that you need to shift from autonomic nervous system in a balance. So I think we put this, all this together, there is a tremendous role for using yoga as a countermeasure for physiological changes of microgravity.
Has NASA ever tried this, Joan?
Joan? Have you heard that?
Joan, are you there? Did we lose her?
I don't know.
I don't know. I mean, hello, Joan. The line is still on. It hadn't gone to dial tone. But do you know if we've ever, if NASA has ever tried this? Hello, Joan.
I'm here. I'm listening.
No, I know you're listening. I guess I can call her back. Joan? I think I just heard the phone click. So she may have gotten disconnected.
She has even heard what I just told.
Can you hear me?
Oh, now we can hear you, yes.
Oh, good.
Did you hear what he was talking about?
Yes, oh, absolutely. And I couldn't agree with him more, because there's a tremendous repertoire that can be used by the individual. You see, what is it? Let me tell you something that is very important. You exercise once a day, right?
I wish.
You think that that's going to take care of all your needs. But I remember Steve Hawley, the astronaut astronomer, telling me one time that the minute you stop exercising, you exercise your little heart out. The minute you stop exercising, you feel like you've done nothing. Now, this is very different than when you exercise on Earth and you go flat out, and the minute you finish, your heart rate still remains up and you're panting and sweating and doing whatever. In microgravity, you can exercise 1 hour, 4 hours a day. But the minute you stop, you're back in microgravity. And it's like responding and readjusting to microgravity all over again, all every day, all the time, the minute you're not exercising. So the only solution, in my view, to a countermeasure in space is that you have to stimulate yourself, your body, every day, throughout the day, on and off, just like on Earth where we use gravity on and off. We either sit down or lie down, we don't use it, and we stand up and we move and we use it. That doesn't happen in space. So we are not replicating what our body is used to, what our body has evolved with it in gravity. So the only way you are going to maintain people in good health is to give them something that will provide stimulation, provide relaxation. It's an on and off. It's relaxation and stimulation, and relaxation and stimulation in an alternating manner throughout the day that you can do. And you can't build machines that are going to do that for you. You can't take pills that are going to do that for you. And that's where yoga is so fantastically fundamental.
Does NASA have any experience working with astronauts in yoga?
Not officially, not directly. And the trouble is that you have to have someone who understands yoga, you know, I mean really understands yoga. You can't go to the corner gym and take a class of yoga and think you're doing it. Believe me, I've tried.
Yeah, so have I. I took the yoga classes where you go into a heat room, Beekman's or whatever it's called.
Yeah.
I mean, the best part about it was I was the only guy in the class, but it didn't help me any either way.
Well, it helped me. I mean, I must admit that it's extremely helpful.
Hold on, one at a time, please. Go ahead, Joan.
I said it has helped me. It's been extremely valuable to me. I've tried, you know, everything. I've tried hypnosis. I've tried, you name it, over time, just because I want to know. But I think it would be invaluable asset for anyone who plans to go into space to have in their pocket, because then they can do something on and off throughout the day when they're not exercising. I'm not telling them not to exercise, but exercise is only, you know, 50%, 60% effective in protecting them. You still, in spite of all the exercise you do, you still lose 5% bone over 6 months, or up to 30% one of them has lost. 1% a month, okay? Not good. Not good. You can prevent that by, and you can maintain your cardiovascular system, as Dr. Sarkar said, beautifully, with breathing exercises, for heaven's sake. How difficult can that get? What's the objection, you know, to having something like that?
So what is the objection NASA uses to not incorporate this in astronaut training and protocols?
There is no evidence, or, you know, they're all stuck in this exercise rut. They're stuck in it. Okay? Now, if they're going to go to machines, they might as well use an internal human-powered centrifuge, which is what I developed when I was at Ames. The human-powered centrifuge is fantastic. But, again, anything, the one they designed, is so, it's so heavy and so complicated. When what I suggested is something that the astronaut or the personal traveler can get on and off, 10 minutes here, 2 minutes there, whenever they have time, whenever they feel like doing it, throughout the day. It can be a social. It can be more than one person on the spinning plate, and something light and user friendly. And we're not user friendly people enough. No, just these heavy machines that keep breaking, because when they're overused, the resistive exercise is just that way, it keeps breaking.
Dilip, do you have anything more to add, please?
Yeah, I just want to let the audience know the exercise, which was a part of our, you know, the treatment protocol, or even for a conventional medicine, and we're trying to find it out more and more that a relaxation response is a better tool, and relaxation response is sustainable. The effect of exercise, as Joan says, is a short-term, sporadic, or sustainable. So we have a lot of publication, research. You know, I'm one of the researchers. We have an association called International Association of Yoga Therapists, and I am the new elected president of that, and we are doing a research on the effect of yoga on the physical body and also as a treatment for different diseases. Again, NASA is going to accept the yoga as a part of their pre-flight or in-flight protocol when they have enough what we call evidence-based medicine. We are collecting the evidence, submitting to NASA, and hope John will help us to train these astronauts to bring all these breathing exercises, yogic relaxation techniques, to go up to the long space travel. Thank you for giving me that.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your calling in.
Thank you.
Listeners, if you want to call again, it's 1-866-687-7223. So medicine is based on evidence-based medicine, as he's suggesting. Of course, the flight surgeons and the people doing all of this for NASA and most of the research studies that I've talked about on the show with the PIs are all based on evidence-studied type of medicine. So is that a handicap for the Inspiration Mars mission?
Hope not. I think the Inspiration Mars mission has an opportunity, to jumpstart and try some of these solutions that may be available within the time frame that they're working. You know, not 50 years from now. Evidence-based research, if you look at how many thousands of years yoga's been around and how many millions of people use it, probably something. There are studies now that are showing the benefits. The thing is to design something that is specifically, of all of the yoga repertoire, specifically useful in microgravity. If someone is trained in the yoga tradition before they go, if they learn what it truly feels like to be relaxed, you know, one of the cosmonauts said to me, I asked him, what is the worst part of being in space? He said, not being able to relax. In other words, I wake up in the morning, I've slept 8 hours or whatever, and I don't feel rested. And that is a very interesting comment, because if we can teach how to relax, how to truly feel totally relaxed, surely you can do that with breathing, with relaxation and conscious relaxation and meditation in a way that does not require gravity.
You have an email from our friend Bill Rowan and a caller on hold. So this is what Bill said. In microgravity, there is already a shift of fluid to the upper part of the body. Why intensify the problem? With exercise in macrogravity, there is invariably increase in core body temperature because of shifting away from the lower extremities. Yoga may intensify this problem. In your thoughts?
No, I don't think so. I think, if anything, yoga will keep body temperature. Body temperature in space goes down, okay?
Uh-huh.
When you exercise, you overheat because the body is not used to. It's a bigger swing. You're not in control. Your temperature is not controlled as well in space as it is on the ground. But if you can prepare yourself with respiration and with relaxation and with all the contraction and relaxation, basically that's what it is. That's what you're doing in gravity all day. You're contracting and you're relaxing. You're contracting and you're relaxing. The trick is to know how to relax completely. How many people do you think you know, and probably you are one of them, who goes around, running around like crazy all the time? You think you're relaxed. You think when you sit down you're relaxed, but you're not.
No, I'm not deluding myself that I'm relaxed, but a lot of people are, but you're right, that everybody's pretty strung out and stressed out.
And it's learning to recognize that feeling of really letting go completely. Then the trajectory to a contraction and to relaxation becomes more significant. It may be at a different level in microgravity than it is in the presence of gravity. But as long as the trajectory is there of relaxing and contracting, relaxing and contracting, whatever way you induce that, with either isometric contraction or with breathing, relaxation, concept, you know, it's understanding what the body needs. We don't start from understanding in our traditional medicine from what the body needs. What's the body telling us?
Let's see who's on the line. Good morning, caller. Who are you, please?
Bill Rowe again.
Yeah, hi, Bill.
I've got to take issue with you and with the physician who called in. But you cannot apply the principles on Earth with the advantages of yoga and use it in microgravity in my way of thinking. I've never thought about this before, but there, we know, we've known ever since 1995 that there is increased in core body temperature with exercise in space. And I have just published, and it's gone through peer review a few months ago, the fact that I believe that the major reason that there's an increase in core body temperature with exercise in space is because of the shift of fluid, or at least one of the major reasons, is because of shift of fluid to the upper part of the body. And with a shift of fluid to the upper part of the body, you're reducing the amount of blood flow in the lower extremities. And when you reduce the blood flow in the lower extremities, you're losing a considerable advantage of the loss of heat through convection. And you're going to do nothing but intensify this major problem by doing yoga. It's absolutely, in my estimation, physically illogical to do yoga in space. The other problem is this, that with invariably the increase in body heat, and this was first presented at a space meeting in 1995, and Anders Hansen from London informed me about this, the problem is that if you increase the body heat, which invariably occurs, you lose more magnesium in the sweat, you lose more magnesium through the kidneys, and there is invariably a decrease in magnesium already. Plus the fact that if you waste time doing yoga in space, you're reducing the amount of exercise.
Oh, not at all. You're very wrong, Bill. Very, very, very wrong. Basically wrong. I'll tell you why. First of all, you do not have an increase in body temperature when you are not exercising in space. Okay?
There is invariably an increase in body temperature with exercise.
You're talking about exercise. I'm not talking about exercise. Okay? You're talking about a shift, a headward shift of fluid. With yoga, you can control the shift in body fluid towards the head. You can control it. You can measure it. You can bring it down. It is no different. You've heard of resistive inspiration and its effect on the parasympathetic nervous system. Yogic breathing is one of the types of yogic breathing is resistive inspiration. You can actually manipulate your blood shift through the way you breathe. And there is a variety of different breathing activities. I'm not talking about moving your legs and your arms and standing on your head. I'm talking about breathing techniques, contracting and relaxing, and things you can do and can be effective in microgravity.
But the doctor is talking about basically standing on your head.
On the ground.
But what he's talking about is intensifying the shift of fluid to the upper part of the body.
No.
He's talking about standing on your head.
No, you're talking about the shift of body fluid.
But what I'm talking about is what the doctor has said.
No. What he said was the shift in body fluids by standing on your head on the ground before you go and training your cardiovascular system to shift on demand to up or down.
But you're talking about before you go, but we're going to be up for 20 months. I'm talking about what you're going to do day in and day out, day in and day out. He's implying that you're going to do this periodically throughout the day for 20 months.
I hope so.
But,
you are.
But
it becomes
physiologically, it doesn't make sense physiologically in microgravity.
You breathe, don't you?
It makes no sense in microgravity because you're shifting blood away from the lower extremities, and that's just what you don't want to do because you're losing the mechanism, one of the mechanisms of losing body heat because there is a reduced ability in the lower extremities to lose body heat through convection.
There is no convection in space.
Well, there's every time you have body heat, the body reacts to body heat in really two ways, basically. Number one is sweating, and number two is by increasing the blood flow to the periphery and through convection and transfer of heat to the air on the surrounding area, losing body heat. I just published this 2 months ago, and it went through peer review.
But this is irrelevant to our discussion.
It's gone through peer review just 2 months ago.
Exercise. We're not talking about exercise. Exercise in space or on the ground is one time a day. It's one time a day. It is not what we do all day long, which is move about, which I've described in my book, Sit and Kill. The necessity to do non-exercise activities all the time, all day long, every day. And that's what the body needs. The body needs tuning. The body needs, it doesn't need exercise. Exercise may be nice and then may be an additive, but it basically needs tuning, on and off, contraction, relaxation, all day long below a certain threshold. Now, that's what the body needs to remain tuned and remain fit and healthy. You can do exercise over and above that once a day or whatever you want to do to increase your endurance or increase your strength. But basically, the body needs moving on and off throughout the day. And that is what we have found to be effective in terms of non-exercise activities. I've done it, the thermogenic activities. They are non-exercise. They are below a certain threshold. You talk to any astronaut in space, and one of the things they feel is what they will tell you is cold under the skin. The body temperature drops in space. The body temperature drops in bed rest.
But
yes,
the body
when you exercise, it rises.
With exercise is increasing.
Yeah, but you're talking exercise. I'm not talking about exercise.
But I'm talking about exercise. That's
who's
what
going
I'm
to have machines
about
on
you
this
got
spacecraft?
To exercise or they're going to die. The problem is that Ludlow has shown that too much, both too much and too little exercise will shorten the telomeres, which maintain stability of the chromosomes. And if these telomeres are excessively shortened, the lifespan will be shortened in turn. It's impossible to find the right amount of exercise in space. I believe, after 20 years of research, it is impossible in microgravity. It's impossible.
No, I don't believe that's true. And it's just that they're doing the wrong kind of exercise and that they're not doing it throughout the day. The minute they stop, they're in microgravity. And what they have done in terms of exercise was only effective during the time they did it. That's it. 4 hours, the Russians did up to 4 hours of exercise a day. 2 hours, which is the most customary. That's it. And what do you do the other 22 hours?
I've already published the fact that if an astronaut has to exercise 4 hours a day, he's going to need to take a psychiatrist with him, because no human being on Earth can tolerate the amount of exercise that it will require to reduce bone loss and skeletal muscle loss in space. It's impossible.
Well, there has been one Russian cosmonaut who did not get along with his colleagues, who exercised throughout the day, 8 hours. He was on the treadmill, on and off throughout the day. He came back with hardly any changes in his body.
But he did. Joan, I'm sorry, I hate to do this, but it's been published by the Russians.
I don't care if it's been
but
published.
The Russians
it
published
is not true.
But after 5 months, a vessel dilator called atrionatriuretic peptide and nitric oxide, both of them, were not detectable after 5 months in this Russian, after 5 months, and this has been published by the Russians.
Yeah, but that is with exercise, okay?
I don't know how much they exercise.
Well,
but after 5 months, these vessel dilators were not detectable and did not return until 3 months after return back to Earth.
You've made my point, which is that the exercise that they have been doing, 2 to 4 hours, the cosmonauts, in spite of that, you get these changes.
I'm getting notes that other people want to call in before
right,
we end the show.
Thanks very, very much. It's been a marvelous program, and I'm sorry to argue, but anyhow, it's been great. Thank you.
Thanks, Bill. I have a long email from Andrew, and I hope he can get through on the phone because I really don't want to read a long email. So, Andrew, the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. I'll start on it. Maybe he'll call. So he's got a couple of really long questions. So number one, I'm going to see if I can't shorten it a little bit. Regarding the psychological part of human factors, one of the comparisons people make, wait a minute, this might be him calling. Hold on. Who are you, please? Welcome to the show. Hello?
Hello?
Yes, who is calling, please?
Hi, this is Dilip Sarkar again.
Okay.
I was just going to answer Bill Rowe a little bit, you know.
Okay, but please be quick, because I have a lot of people that want to get in, and we're getting the show's already over time.
I can just a really quick answer for you.
Go ahead.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead. Can you hear us?
Yes.
Go ahead, please.
The answer to what Bill was asking, that if you do this yogic relaxation and all the different postural changes, like head down, sit up, body bend on different sides, the body gets used to the fluid shift, and the brain gets a signal called neuroplasticity. Baroreceptor sensitivity goes up, chemoreceptor sensitivity goes down. So your body is already prepared to go to a microgravity when there is a fluid shift from lower part of the body to the upper part, and the body is already used to it. And baroreceptor sensitivity, neuroplasticity takes care of it. You don't develop the physiological changes what you are going to develop today in gravity.
Okay.
So they have to keep on doing it in a pre-flight for a long period of time. They get trained 2 years before they go to the space. If they train themselves with a breathing exercise, relaxation, different position of the body, shifting the fluid, the body is prepared for a neuroplasticity.
Okay.
That's the answer to the question. He'll say, you know, when you go up there, it'll be a different issue.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Andrew, call in, because I don't want to read your long question. 866-687-7223. That, notwithstanding, here's an attempt to consolidate question one. Regarding the psychological human factors, one of the comparisons people make is with the stressful situations faced by soldiers in foxholes in Guadalcanal or on Iwo Jima. Soldiers spending years in the worst conditions possible. Well, the phone's ringing again. Hello, are you Andrew?
David?
Yes.
It's Andrew calling.
Oh, good. I don't have to read your long emails. All right, you need to speak up. And we're already way long for the show, so try to be consolidated, okay?
Okay. With regards to psychological human factors, one of the comparisons that people make is with the stressful situations faced by soldiers in Guadalcanal, Iwo Jima, things like that. Soldiers spending years in the worst conditions in First World War trenches, U-boat crews on month-long dangerous patrols, Anne Frank and her family hiding in crawl spaces for years, or taking to the extreme things like kamikaze pilots going on missions knowing that they wouldn't come back. So humans gone through a lot worse to achieve a lot less than something like Inspiration Mars. Now,
whoa. You tell me that fighting on Guadalcanal or Iwo Jima or World War One or Two trenches is achieving a lot less than a flyby around Mars. Those guys fought for the very damn freedom that allows you and everyone else that listens to this show, including me, to even ponder the idea of a flyby by Mars. If those guys hadn't made those sacrifices, this show would not exist. I'm a Jew. I would not exist. And you can't do that to people that lived in that crap and in that situation to fight for this nation and freedom and to make that sacrifice. That is not trivial.
No. I'm not trying to degrade that in any way.
Okay, good, because I want to be clear that what they did is far from trivial.
That people have faced these kinds of really stressful situations before, and this has shown that humans are able to tolerate these kinds of conditions better than you would expect. I have the utmost respect.
Just to be clear.
We have no argument about whether they can tolerate the conditions. The question is, will they be able to tolerate each other?
Well, how do they do it on a submarine? Because that's got to be, I mean, I know the discipline is really tight and you can get punished and all that, but, man, you know, they hot bunk. So that means you're in the bed that the guy is on duty was in a couple of minutes ago. So, I mean, I don't know how they do it.
Well, it's training, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess training and discipline, and you follow the Navy has phenomenal rules that you follow, but they also screen like mad to be in the submarine service.
Right, and also it's a question of having no choice. I mean, you've signed up to do something, you're in this, and if you're a quitter, nobody's going to hire you or select you. You are known to be able to, you know, that's why they do rescue training and that sort of thing in the desert and whatever they send astronauts in to do, what they used to.
Survival training.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, survival training. And that's part of the selection process. People not quit. I mean, you're not going to say a month into the installation mission, I want to go back.
My question really is, do you think that one of the things that's different about this situation is that they'll have a lot better communication with friends and family, and they have public support from the entire Earth in a much more visible way than those other situations? And do you think this has any mitigating effect on the psychological issues?
I'm sure it does. To the extent that by that time, you know, communications will be such that they would... I mean, they have already astronauts now that can email their families and so on. It's a whole different situation. Or books being sent up to them for them to read, or music, or whatever. It is a completely different environment than it used to be. And I'm sure this is a mitigating... What was your other question? Hello?
Yeah, Andrew.
What do you consider the biggest human factors challenge, and how do you think that it will be overcome?
Sorry, I couldn't hear that.
What do you consider the biggest human factors challenge, and how do you think it will be overcome?
Overcoming what?
What do you consider the biggest human factors challenge to the mission, and how do you think it will be resolved?
Oh, I'm sure the biggest human factor is the interaction between the two people going. It's a human interaction. And to the extent that their interest, their teamwork is encouraged, there may be computer programs that can be developed that maintain their sense of confidence, self-confidence, or working together to solve a problem. Encouraging team spirit, much like the Russians did with their chamber study that mimicked the Mars mission. They had a lot of these programs that encouraged team solution of a problem. Okay, the problem wasn't real, but to the extent that they worked as a team to solve a problem, was very, very, kept them busy, kept them interested, and kept them working together. And I think that is probably the most important thing. Can be done. I'm not that concerned about the human factors aspect. I think it has to be addressed, but it can be done.
Is training together on Earth a predictor of how they will react on a mission?
No. I mean, that was quick.
I like that.
What, the quick?
Yeah, the quick, yeah. I'm all for quickies as we're coming up on a two-hour show.
I think you have to take it with a pinch of salt. It's not absolute. Let's put it that way.
So we don't know, and I don't really think we have any real reason to know, especially at this point, who is in charge of and who will design and what the team will consist of those designing the pre-mission training and all the protocols that the crew will have to use. So one can hope that whoever is going to have the responsibility for doing this before flight and in selection and then, you know, during the flight, is going to know the issues that you're talking about and a lot more, and we'll go back in history to see what has been done and what has worked and not worked, so that whatever they come up with for this mission will consist of viable pre-flight as well as during flight, and then I'm sure post-flight protocols to protect the health of the crew as best as possible. But we don't really have any information on any of this at this point.
No, we don't, but I'm confident there is a lot of information and studies that have been done on cosmonauts and astronauts and the interactions with the ground and all that sort of stuff, and confinement studies, okay? They're not directly relevant, but they provide a whole lot of information basis. But you know, it's like finding yourself in a situation that someone else is experiencing. You cannot put yourself entirely into that person's situation. You never can. So you don't know how you will react. You know, if someone told you you were stuck on an island in the Pacific, being bombarded by the Japanese or whatever, and you were the only one there, you would empathize. But you, in your gut, you wouldn't, in your bones, you wouldn't feel the way that person felt. So it's very difficult to project.
You know, I have done shows with one of my professor associates and friends at the University of North Dakota Space Studies Department,
mm-hmm.
Dr. Regaloff. I think you may have. Okay. So the dean worked the Soviet Union program on Mir with the mental part of the astronauts. And so what he said is that starting about 4 months into a mission, you start to detach from Earth. Now, this is in LEO, where you can still see Earth.
Yeah.
And as you go out to 6 months and longer, you detach even more from Earth. And what they had to do in those early Mir crews and for the longer missions that they did is they had to devise ways to keep the cosmonauts associated with Earth. And this was before they had email and all the ways for families to communicate back and forth. But those are the kinds of things they did.
Yes.
Now, going to Mars, not only do you disassociate from Earth
mm-hmm.
as you go further and further out, but also your ability to recognize Earth disappears.
Very
so that dissociation from Earth becomes even more pronounced.
This separation from Earth is extremely critical and important, and we shouldn't underestimate it. The Apollo crew, the guy who orbited the moon, Tor 1 has told me that of the feeling of loss and loneliness when they were on the dark side of the moon and could not see Earth and were totally uncoupled from Earth. And you know, we can say some became depressed, some went off and did strange things, or nothing happened. It is not something they like to talk about, but it is very real.
Well, absolutely. So imagine going out further and further and further to Mars to the point where you can't recognize Earth. It's just a dot in the sky.
Yeah. That is probably the most critical human factor.
So
all the more reason to try it and see what happens. I mean, we won't know the answers to these kinds of questions until we do something like this.
Well, or you devise analog studies. I wouldn't say definitively you don't know the answer. I mean, I support the mission if they can pull it off. But to say that you don't know the answer to something unless you actually do it, I think our research has come up with some pretty viable analog studies that give us good information whether this is a possibility or not. You do have the Mars 500 or whatever that experiment was in Russia.
Yes.
So you do have some information coming out of that. Of course, there was also an experiment or something they did, and I'm trying to remember if it was for a joke or a TV show or something, where they put people inside a thing and made them believe that they were going on a real space mission. Do you remember about this?
I'm
I guess we could Google it to get the detail, but a lot of the people really freaked out from this.
Yeah.
So it was a virtual reality thing. You went into, like, you're in the Starship Enterprise or something like that, and it was all virtual reality but made to be really real with movement and vibration and sound and everything, and you were really pulling away from Earth and really going on a space mission, and people really freaked out with that. So you probably don't want them going on the Mars mission.
No.
But they would probably self-police themselves and not volunteer anyway.
Yeah.
So, I think some pretty tough people will volunteer. I think there'll be a lot of self-policing.
Oh, yes.
You know, if you know you're claustrophobic, you're not going to sign up for this one.
Not likely.
Andrew, what else, my friend?
No, thank you, David. That's all the questions I have. I'll clear the line for someone else.
Thank you.
Towards the end of the show.
I'm not going to clear the line for someone else. We're at the two-hour point, Joan. How would you like to wind us up and... Well, actually, I got a final note from Bill Rowe again. All of us must try to provide counter arguments. As you know, if I sounded too heated, accept my apology. You had a difficult subject and you were an excellent guest, one of the best programs. And Bill, never apologize. Don't you know that rule?
No.
Just go forward. Never apologize.
I'm honored.
What do you have for pearls of wisdom for us, closing comments on this subject? Go Mars, is that it?
Exactly, go Mars, but don't go with your, garden cart. Go with some creative thinking, opening your mind, taking advantage of possibilities that are out there. You know, they don't have to be all evidence-based. They have to be practical, and they have to be desirable, and they're going to have to be things that the people will do for themselves. If they appreciate that they need to do them for themselves, they will do them. Otherwise, they will be like submariners who don't exercise for a duration of a stay, only just before they start coming back up. And that's not the solution. They will have to use and provide them with tools that they will use, whatever those tools are. And they'll include communication. They will include virtual and actual computer problem solving. And they will include activities such as yoga, such as meditation, that will allow them to use their space, even if it's their inner space, to calm down and solve problems and maintain their health at the level that they'd like to maintain.
Well, it'll be interesting watching their progress over the coming years and see if they're going to be able to make a 2018 launch.
But as you say, go Mars.
Go Mars. And I'm sure we'll be talking to you more about this as we see their progress over the ensuing 5 years. And we'll see. Do you have another book coming out?
I'm working on one. It's a slightly different aspect, a perspective on stress and what stress is. and it all comes down to energy. And that's all I'll say about it.
When do you think that'll be out?
I'm hoping it'll be out mid-2014.
And listeners, again, if you have not checked out her book, Sitting Kills?
Sitting Kills, Moving Heals.
I just urge you to do so. The techniques that Joan teaches and the information she has in it, look, you can. This is so simple, you'll wonder why you never thought of it yourself. And I think it can make a big difference in how you feel if you just incorporate it into your day. I mean, don't get up while you're driving your car, but other than that, or when you're flying into Reagan Airport in Washington, D.C., I don't think TSA will take Joan's book as an excuse.
No, but I have some good success stories, including George Mueller. I'll have to tell you about that.
Okay. Thank you for being with us for 2 hours today, and I look forward to talking to you down the road.
Okay.
Thank you
very much for listening
okay.
on.
And listeners, back with Chris Carberry of Explore Mars. They have a fascinating conference coming up called Humans to Mars, which has everybody and anybody in the Mars community that is attending, and Chris will be our guest on Sunday. They also did a young person's survey on going to Mars, and we'll talk about that. A couple of other organizations joined in with them, and you might find that interesting. That survey is on ExploreMars.org's website if you want to check it out. Thank you all for being with us and for participating in today's Space Show program. Goodbye, everyone.